The following podcast is part of a special oral history program titled The RSL, A Time to Celebrate. The program documents fascinating and personal stories and experiences of veterans across South Australia. The program received funding through the Veteran and Community Grants stream in partnership with the Tanunda RSL sub-branch and the Emu Tree, and was produced by Christian Teusner. I encourage listeners to take their time to explore as many of these stories and adventures as possible. For further information, visit www.theemutree.com. Today is the 12th of June 2020. I'm sitting here in Fifth Avenue, Cheltenham with Jim Stevens. Thank you, Jim, for participating in this oral history program, The RSL, A Time to Celebrate. Can I please ask you just to start off and just to state your full name, your service number and your date of birth, please?
I'm Walter James Antcliffe Stevens. I was born on the 30th of October 1931. My service number is 4/1141. I can't remember the name of the nurse that delivered me. But my mother was living at Tarcoola at the time with my father, who was a fireman on the Commonwealth Railways, and she had to come down to Port Augusta to deliver the baby. Rather a long trip. My father finished up on the East-West Railways, travelling between Tarcoola and Port Augusta, back to Tarcoola, then from Tarcoola through to Barwon and back to Tarcoola again. And I was about 4 years old when he got transferred to Bell Tanner. That was on the Alice Springs line. And he was there until I was about 5 years old, and he got coal dust on the lung. Of course, he had to retire. So we moved back to Kapunda, where my mum was born, to be close to her family. And I lived at Kapunda for the rest of my schoolboy years. I attended the Kapunda Primary School and the Kapunda High School. And when I left school, I was working for Clem Linke, the local electrician. I was instrumental in saving his life one day. We were working at the garage. He was up on top of the office roof, pulled the fuses, switched all the mains off. And in those days, of course, it was the old-fashioned tubing and wiring. And he undone the junction box, pulled the wires out, grabbed them to pull them apart, and that was as far as he got. And, of course, I was just coming up the ladder to see what he was doing. Jesus, he couldn't let go. He'd bounce around on the roof. Raced down, thought someone put the fuses back in. Nope. So I raced outside and reefed the external wires out of the socket outside. Got in trouble with the ETSA over that too. Why did I do that? And it appeared that Dad put the earth wire in the wrong place and had the live wire going where the earth wire should have been, which meant, of course, you pull the fuses and everything's still live. Not long after that, I gave that job away.
Can I ask you, Jim, did you recall any early memories from your primary school days?
I don't know whether I should mention some of them.
Go on.
Well, in those days, the primary school had two rows of toilets up the top of the yard. One side was the girls, the other side was the boys. Of course, in those days, it was the old bucket. Down the middle was this alleyway where the nightmen used to come and collect the buckets to take them out to empty them. Well, us boys, we got the idea climbing up on the wall, jumping down the middle, going along. And when the girls sat down on the toilets, lift the latten, tickle them with a feather. It was all right. But we knew you must not go to that end one, because that was the teacher's. One silly devil decided to have a do that. Teacher jumped up screaming, looked around and saw this smiling face. Needless to say, that put a stop to that. Originally, we lived right opposite the primary school, and it was fun. I remember in grade one, teacher clipped me under the ears because someone was talking behind me. I said, that wasn't me. So she gave me another clip. So I kicked her in the shins and took off home. And the teacher lived opposite us. She was a great friend of Mum's. She went to school with her. "Look what your son did to me with his little boots. Nice big bruise on the shins." I didn't get beaten again by her, needless to say. But I remember during the war, we were making camouflage nets. So after school and weekends, we'd be out there making camouflage nets. I think I've still got the somewhere a little card from the CWA, I think it was, that was organising this. And it was our effort towards the war effort, and I guess it was appreciated. But
that was something the whole school was working on?
No, or it was just a few of us who, you know, were interested. And it was quite an interesting thing. I learned how to make knots and things. And we had the string was on a sort of a needle, big wooden needle thing, and feed it through and tie it off in there. And those nets were quite large, so we used to hang them up onto the coat hangers in the passageway, and we'd have all these camouflage nets hanging down. But, then, of course, the Kapunda High School at that time was a hospital for the service, and we used to watch them riding around in their Bren gun carriers, which was good fun, especially when we cared to ride out of them.
How did you feel as a child when World War II was on? Do you remember your interpretation of what it was all about?
It was too far away. We were literally divorced from it because we didn't have blackouts or anything. Like they did in the city, you know, they used to have blackouts and everything. But we did have a trench in the schoolyard, and we used to grow all our own veggies and everything in those days. But the father, he was working on farms, mostly on farm work at that time. And eventually after the war, I used to go out with him rabbit trapping. He'd spend the day on the farm, and then night time we'd go out and set 500 rabbit traps up in the hills between Kapunda and Tarlee. And we'd get up to 2,000 rabbits a night, which we had. All we did was to slip down each leg and take out everything underneath the diaphragm. The heart, the liver and the kidneys used to have to be left in. Pair them, hang them over the fence to cool. And by 7 o'clock in the morning, we'd have them all down to the train at Tarlee to go to Adelaide. We used to get a halfpenny a pair. That's half a cent a pair for two rabbits. But when you've got 8 kids in the family, it worked out, you know, quite a bit of money. But, that was during school holidays and that. And go out with him making fence posts. Cut down a tree, cut it into lengths. And this is with the old cross-cut saw, no chainsaw. I'll be on one end, he'd be on the other. Cut the tree down, split it into four to make 4 posts, and then cut them out and start putting fences up. That was good. But then he started working down at Greenock on the grapevines, picking grapes and pruning grapes and all that sort of thing. I finished up, I used to have to go down and help him there. We had an old horse and dray, and from Kapunda to Greenock's about 18 miles, I suppose. And we'd go down picking grapes, be out there at bloody dawn, finish him just before dark, back to the farmhouse, and old Billy went. He had a 4-gallon drum of port in the back of the garage. A couple of slurps of port, and then home. But my father won the grape picking contest one year in the Brossa, and I could almost keep up with him. It was a bit too fast for me.
How long would that journey take you from Kapunda to Greenock?
Oh, half an hour, I suppose. More. I often rode my bike down there. Well, if you could call it a bike. It was made up of bits and pieces scrounged from the local rubbish dump. But it was a good life. I enjoyed it.
Good memories.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The only problem was, I'd be picking grapes all day. Comes payday, he'd click my pay. What more do you want? I'm feeding and clothing you. it was fair enough. But it taught me, you know, the value of the price of money. When I first started work after leaving school, I was getting 10 shillings a week. That's $1 a week for a 48-hour week. 6 days. Mum used to take 9 and 6 pence board, leave me with 6 pence.
And what were you doing? What was that first job?
That was with the electrician.
That was the, okay, yeah.
But after that I got a job down at Freeling at Lincoln Oaks factory It was a foundry, actually. That was a rather interesting job. All I was doing was grinding pliers. They used to make pliers, car parts, all sorts of things, universal joints. That big stamp mill there, put a piece of red hot metal in the die, down it comes this thing, whack. You get a big flange around the outside of it. That'd go into another machine, would press that out, and with the pliers you had to grind that sharp edge off. And that was my job, sitting there, just grinding bloody pliers. I didn't take kindly to that. So my auntie, who lived in Adelaide, she decided, I can get a job for you down in Adelaide, an apprentice, as an upholsterer. That lasted for about 2.5 years. He was a mad bugger. I'm not kidding.
Can you elaborate a little bit more?
If he was cutting a piece of material and he made a mistake, he'd hurl the shears across the workroom. And or if he hit himself with a hammer, he'd hurl the hammer across the workroom. And nothing better than me sitting down there and have a pair of, and when I say shears, they were about that bloody long, you know, massive big upholstery shears. I got sick of this. So I was up in town one day and I went past the recruiting depot and I thought, oh, I wonder. I went inside and I said to the fellow, oh, I'm an apprentice. I said, but, you know, I've still got a couple of years to go yet. Doesn't matter, we can get you out of that. Okay, I'll sign up. So I did.
And how old were you when you signed up?
18. But I already had 2 years service with the 3rd Ninth Mounted Rifles, CMF. And so I thought, you know, army life's not that hard. But it was, you know, interesting.
How did you feel at that point? Was it a big adventure? Were you anxious? Were you excited?
Anything to get out of the apprenticeship. I wanted out, you know. But unfortunately, you wouldn't let me go. But the army got me out of it. I finished up going to Pakapanyo, their recruit training. And because I'd already had 2 years with the CMF, they decided, you know, they'd stick me out at Site 17 with all the K-Force fellas. They were chaps that signed up for 2 years. Most of them were ex-World War II chaps. You know, half of them were one step ahead of the cops, behind with their alimony payments and getting away from trouble. And they were a really rough bunch. 300 of them. And they had their own brothel. They rented a farmhouse and got a couple of girls up from Melbourne. They taught me how to pick locks. I used to break into the kitchen of a night time and take what you wanted. I remember one time they wanted us to go across to the headquarters and dig a hole to put in a petrol bowser. Well, we got down about 3 feet and we struck solid rock. One of them said, look, he said, I worked at the mines as a explosive expert. He said, can we just blast a bit? Oh yeah. Well, we drilled the holes. He was an expert, all right. He put about 10 times as much explosives in there as was needed. And the hole that we found was supposed to be big enough to take a tank, you know, for the petrol. It would have been about 30 yards long and 20 yards wide. And one of the rocks went straight over the top of the 2-story building and landed on the parade ground behind. Needless to say, we got taken off that job. Then we were due to go to Korea. I'd had my pre-embarkation leave and we were shifting the camp because they were closing it down at Site 17, taking us back to Pakapanyo. We were on the opposite side of Seymour to Pakapanyo. And we had a truckload of tent floorboards, you know, the old marquee floorboards, 6x6 and heavier than a bloody packing, loaded up on the back of this truck. We had 6 of us on the back of the truck behind them. We said, don't go under the bridge in Seymour, it's too low. Go through the railway yards, over the railway line, and back down. Nah. He decided he'd go straight under the bridge. It didn't work, because we had the boards stacked up, upright on the back of the 6 diggers and a truckload of floorboards in the middle of the road, and under this bridge. It was about an hour after lunch, and one had come down on my stomach corner-wise. And I'm lying on the road, and I can still remember this little old lady looking down at me and saying, are you all right, laddie? Are you all right? And I couldn't even get enough breath in to say, of course, I'm not your silly old biddy, you know. But that memory's still with me. That they shipped me back to Buckapunyal to the camp hospital, kept me there overnight. Next morning, my stomach was blown up like a balloon, black and blue, and I was really crook. So they transferred me down to Heidelberg Repat in an old Blitz ambulance with square wheels. I'm sure it had square wheels. It was army bloody truck wheels. I don't remember anything after that for 3 weeks, but I was on the critical list. They brought my mum over because it looked like dying. And first thing when I woke up was, oh, me leg, you know, and a transverse fracture of the patella of the kneecap. Too late to do anything with it, it already started to heal. It was very interesting in Heidelberg. They kept me there for about 3.5 months. I started to get stir crazy. I used to have a wood fire in the ward, so I went out the back and got the axe and I decided I was going to chop the ward up. I woke up the next morning, nurse, I can't move, I'm paralysed. I was in a straitjacket. So, are you all right? Yeah, I want out of this place, I've had enough. Well, they sent me out, gave me 3 months to live. Oh dear, oh well, down to the pub, back at the hospital. But so they turned me out again.
What age were you, Jim, while this was all happening?
19. Yeah. And so they posted me to Headquarters Southern Command as a clerk. I spent the next 9 months on a Gestetner machine. That's one of these machines for printing off duplicate copies. And the 2 Battalion was going to Korea, and they were short. So I said, right, back to the battalion. 2 weeks before they left, I didn't know a soul. Didn't have time to even say hello to anyone because they were busy, you know, moving out. And way to Korea on the New Australia. Well, it wasn't what you'd call good because I didn't have a clue who anyone was. I got to Korea and I went for a final medical. Dr. Kwanlung said, what the hell? Massive, great, raw scar down here, you know, another one across the ear. What the heck? Oh, bugger it, your ear will stay. That was it. And straight into the Korean War then. But I won't say I enjoyed my time there. I did have some good friends. They're all gone now, unfortunately. But I remember my first patrol was with Jimmy Murder, the platoon sergeant. He was ex-bomb disposal in New Guinea after the war, which meant, you know, his attitude was, why worry? If it kills you, it will. If it doesn't, it won't. So we go out in this patrol, 3-man recce patrol. Johnny Worsfold was the signaller, myself, and Jimmy Murder. And hey, he took us right up into the Chinese lines and out again. Coming back, he said, tell me when we come to a fence, he said, because there's a minefield between us and them, you know, us and we'll follow the minefield back. And come to this fence. Whoops, there's a fence here, right. We'll follow the fence. Oh, there's another fence. Oh, shit, he said. We just walked through the minefield. A bloody wire had been put up on an old tree stump. We'd walk straight underneath. What do we do? No worries. If you set one off, he said, you won't know about it. So we got back and I thought, I don't want to go out with you again. But, yeah, we had some fun. We were on 227, I think it was at the time. 355 was on our right, and that was where 3 Battalion were. It was very interesting. We moved into the front line. It's supposed to be all hush-hush, you know. First thing in the morning, these loudspeakers opposite, on the valley opposite. Welcome to the line, 2nd Battalion of the Royal Australian Regiment. We trust you'll be as good as your previous regiment. And we'll give you a few minutes rest, and then we will give you a welcome. Oh, of course, being Mug Alex, we're all up there looking around. Well, what the hell's going on? What's going on? Yeah, we got a welcome, all right. I started mortaring. You've never seen so many scared rabbits in your life. One fella, drainage trench that went out, draining water out of the trench, he got himself in there and he couldn't get out. He was stuck. How he got in, I don't know. I think it might have been just shit scared. But, you look back now, you laugh at it, but at the time it was a bit serious. But after we pulled out of there, we went back in the rest area. Not exactly rest area, only 5 mile back from the front line. And then we took over on the hook. That was a little bit different. Overlooked the valley, which was one of the main communication lines between North and South Korea, and they wanted that badly. But, they gave us a fair sort of pasting there. And talk of the truce at the time, but, you know, you just sort of didn't worry about that. It was just one of those things that you, yeah, I'll believe it when it happens sort of thing.
Mm. I was just going to ask, did you ever think one day this will stop, one day it'll come to sort of resolution? And
yeah, you hope. You know, they kept talking about it. But then they put in this attack on us and they shelled us for 24 hours. We had something like 4,000 shells dropped on us in 24 hours, shells and mortars. Made a hell of a mess of the bloody position. And then they attacked. It was an all-night attack and I was on the Bren gun. I hate to think of the number of people I killed, and I thought afterwards, you know, how many husbands, brothers, and that bloody night, I got hit by a bloody mortar.
Do you recall the moment?
Don't remember a thing. Very little memory of anything from at least a fortnight beforehand. Jimmy Murder, I saw him in Japan when he was on R&R, and he said, I heard the bang. He said, looked around. He said, all I could see was arms and legs. I thought, oh, Jesus, you're gone. But it just knocked me out completely. I come to on a stretcher on an airplane, on a DC-3 flying across to Japan. I was like a jelly, just, you know, whole body. And it was like that for about 3 weeks. Part of my memory's been just shot, you know, sort of have faint recollections occasionally, bits and pieces coming. Did that really happen? Can't remember it. But I was perfectly good. Bren gun behind. I got back to Australia 2 years later, and they still had a Bren gun on my registered to my name. I'm sure I didn't have it. But I got to Japan. I was in Bridcom Base, Kure Base Hospital for a month. They finally got my nerves settled, sent me out to Miyajima for another month, come back to RHU, reinforcement holding unit in Hiro, waiting to come home. All we were doing was going around every morning, painting rocks around the roadways in the camp with whitewash. Anything to make him, bloody, that drove us nuts. And so they're looking for a clerk, temporary clerk at the headquarters. I'll take it, anything to get out of this. 2 years later, I came home, finished up on the Ostarmy component headquarters as a clerk, and I really enjoyed that time. That's where I met my wife, walking down the main drag in here one day, and I saw this girl waiting at the bus. I went, now that's nice. She got on the bus and away she went. I thought, oh, well, too bad. Didn't have time to make her a plans. About a month later, a mate of mine, he was living with this girl. He'd come around for a cup of tea. I thought, oh, you're right, I've got nothing else to do. Went around there, he said, oh, we'll get the girl next door to come in, and tapped on the thing. This girl, it's her. Made her acquaintance. And I finished up marrying her. But
how many years married now, Jim?
Been married now, this year it'll be 66 years. Got married 3 times. Married in the Japanese registry, then the British consul to make it legal everywhere else, because at that time we were still, you know, not at peace with Japan, strangely enough. And then in the church with the padre. So I'm sort of stuck with it because I don't think I could afford 3 divorces. She's been a lovely girl. I had a good life. I came back to Australia.
Could you just tell me your wife's name?
Tokiko. T-O-K-I-K-O. Saeki. S-A-E-K-I.
Do you have any photographs of that kind of period?
Yeah. I've got some. I'll come out there. I'll bring them in a minute.
Yeah, okay, terrific.
But, we came back. And then I got posted to Port Augusta. Coltana. So she was living at Kapunda with my mum and I'm up at Port Augusta. That was a bit rough because she didn't speak English, my mum certainly didn't speak Japanese, but they got on right. eventually I got posted back to Woodside National Service training, and we managed to get a house in the married quarters at Inverbrecky. And
so what were your responsibilities at this point?
Just general infantry training. I was a corporal, and was in general training, and I got back to Woodside, and my first thing I did was a 25-mile route march. Now, for someone that spent 2 years sitting in an office, and another couple of months at Port Augusta doing nothing, I was smart. I brought up the rear. Needless to say, didn't take long to get fit again. But yeah, that was interesting, that training them bloody career. Oh, geez, I tell you. Out on the range, and standing back behind them, you know, when your targets appear, fire, you know. Cease fire, lay your guns down, get your feet. One silly bugger, because it had been raining, poked a piece of 4x2 down the barrel of his rifle. You can imagine what happened when he pulled the trigger. Blew the bloody breech out. He didn't get hurt, thank God. Had a look along the line, yeah. Half of them have got bits of 4x2 down the barrels. Probably told them what to do.
Have you ever seen that or encountered that before?
No. We weren't ever silly enough to do that. Only these bloody three-month bloody national servicemen that did that sort of thing. Because, you know, we used to always pick them because they didn't have their barrels cleaned properly. And then grenade training. You're in the pit. There's a pit, a little wall, and then another underground area. Prepare to throw. They pull the pin out and put their arm back. Throw. And he puts a grenade on the front of the parapet right in front of you. And dives down. Look, that's what you did. Down. Bang. Shrapnel. It was funny, you know, when you look back. At the time it wasn't.
Did you enjoy the role of training and
instructing? It was interesting. But we only had 3 months. It was only 3 months at that time. And that 3 months, you barely started to get a bit of discipline into them, you know. We did get some good fellas through there. I remember one lad, he was a little bit too cheeky, and so I took him behind the toilets one day and gave him a bit of a hiding. And he said, you know, I want to tell my father on you. His father was Sir Lyle McEwen. Come visitor's day, his father was up there, and Gordon Curley, the tune said, "You're wanted in the office." "Why? Who's there? Who wants me?" "Sir Lyle McEwen." Oh dear. Walked in his heart. I said, "You gave my son a hiding." "Yes, he was too damn cheeky." "Put it there," he said. "I should have done it years ago." Oh, thank God. We had some good punishments. Fill their haversack with house bricks on the parade ground for half an hour. If you complain, we'll put a couple more bricks in, do it for another half hour. "On until the padre on you." "Right, we'll do it for another hour." That was the only way to get to some of them.
That's hard work, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Especially when you're standing still just giving the orders. I remember one day, at this drill class, and next thing they're all starting to laugh. I did me lying, lolly, of course. And they're still laughing. Then I look on behind, look, there's my son. Walked from the married quarters over the hill into the camp. And he's standing behind, imitating everything I was doing. Little bugger. That was interesting. I remember when he was born, took him, he was born at Mount Barker. I took Mum across the hospital. And the camp doctor was also the doctor that was treating her outside, you see, marching down the road with a bunch of troops, you know, and the next thing he drove past and, "It's a boy, both well. Thanks, Doc." So I didn't bother ringing the hospital. When I got home that night, there was a dozen women standing on my front door waiting for me. "Why haven't you rung the hospital?" I said, "Why should I? I know what's going on. We've been ringing up all day and they won't tell us anything until the husband's been informed." I said, "I've been informed. The doctor told me this morning." I said, "Why bother ringing if you know what's wrong?" Said, "Well, they went berserk, you know." You look back now and you laugh like hell about it. They meant well, you know, because she was well liked, really well liked. And but I remember the only time I've ever had any real grief was when my son was born. They had a photograph in the Mount Barker Courier, and a photograph of her and me, and she got this letter, and it was vicious. About, you know, being a Jap and all this sort of thing. I didn't tell her about it. I took it to the cops and they couldn't do anything. But I think, so, you know, some people sort of, you know, they forget. Women and kids don't make war. It's rich old men and politicians. I had a friend, he was a prisoner of war in Japan. And he said, "I've got a lot of respect for the women and children in Japan." He said, "Kids used to throw turnips over the fence to us because they weren't really well fed." He said, "And the guards had shoot at them." He said, "And the women working in the mines with us," he said, "they used to share their food with us. If they got caught, the guards would beat them up." He said, "There's nothing against the women and kids," he said. "It's the bloody, you know, it's the males." Well, most of the males that were guarding them in the camp were actually Koreans, not Japanese. And I said, "No, she's gone on well, always has gone on well, even while Secretary Treasurer of the Woodside RSL for 26 years. She was well liked. But, I've had an interesting life. When I came back, I was suffering from PTSD. I was drinking a flagon of port a day. That's 4 litres. Smoking, chain smoking. Got a job at the Farmers Union in the Smallwoods factory as a clerk, doing the payroll and general work. And I got interested in the first aid side. So I was a first aid officer. And then I joined St John's. And I went through, right through the ranks in St John, right up to divisional superintendent. And in the meantime, I was helping on the local ambulance. The local ambulance was owned by the district council. That was the district council of Onkaparinga. Not the Onkaparinga now, but the Onkaparinga that used to be at Woodside. Took in Woodside, Lobethal, Lenswood, mm-hmm. Charleston, Verdun, all that area, Oakbank, Ballina. And they owned the ambulance. And the fellow that was driving it was also the taxi driver. And of course, he quite often, yeah, he liked his little bit of imbibing. And so I used to go out with him on the ambulance, and eventually Farmers Union closed down. So I got a job at the National Bank in Adelaide as a courier and sort of taking care of the front counter observations, you know, checking everything. And
can you put a year on this? Sorry, I'm just trying to work out.
19.
Whereabouts are we now?
Yeah, we're back in 70. It's 72, I think, roughly. Mm. But hard to remember these things now. Dates sort of get away from me. And then the clerk of the council came around one day. He said, "Oh," he said, "the fellow who was doing the ambulances decided to resign. We want you to take over the ambulance." Oh shit, no, I said, "I've got a good job now." I said, "No, I've got to give notice and everything else." I said, "Furthermore," I said, "if I take it over, I want a new vehicle. I want to sit out the way I want it. and I will run it my way. But I'm not going to take what he did. Half of whatever he takes off the ambulance was his. I said, I want a wage, a set wage. I'm not giving him a good job just to take specs on when I get an ambulance call. And I don't think council will agree with that. I said, well, that's my terms. Monday morning he came back and council's agreed to it. When can you start? I said, hang on, I've got to give notice first. So I went down on the Monday, went down to the bank and I told the chief clerk there what had happened. He said, take it. If you don't like it, we'll give you a job back. So I took it. And that's where I stayed. Well, I finished up. I had 26 volunteers working with me. Well, the first 2 years, I was on duty 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Because I had no one trained up. Got the volunteers out of the St. John's and trained them up myself. And they finished up. I had two ambulances and a first aid vehicle. And we used to run the horse trials, you know, like pony clubs, go-kart clubs, all that sort of thing, footy, cricket. We used to attend everything. And we had the first aid vehicle, which was set up more as a mini ambulance. And it worked out quite well. Then I did my paramedics course at the Royal Adelaide Hospital under old Fred Gilligan. We spent 2 weeks at Queen Vic, 2 weeks in the Royal Adelaide in the emergency, 2 weeks up in intensive care, and finished the training. This was back in, yeah, it was in 72. And at the end of it, the AMA said, no, you're not allowed to do it. Forget it. Didn't want paramedics, which was fair enough, I suppose. But I still used to do training. I was on the state ambulance training committee. I was on the commissioner of St. John's advisory committee. This was when they had the transition between volunteer and paid staff. It was a bit of a Barney, that one. And it was almost non-stop. I was never home. But then again, I was also secretary of the RSL, secretary of the Institute Committee, secretary of St. John's, running the ambulance service. I was on the hospital board. I was on the cricket board. I was on the footy board. I was on the swimming pool board. I was on everything.
How did you find the time for all these responsibilities?
That was very, very interesting. Well, without my wife, I wouldn't have been able to manage because she backed me all the way. I finished up in the bicentennial year. I got the Citizen of the Year award, which was very nice. I was also in the Regiments Association. I'm a life member of the Regiments Association until I resigned. Another story. Our treasurer was a serving officer, an officer and a gentleman, who was ripping us off. And the president allowed him to take his discharge before he informed us of it, which we didn't take kindly to, so we voted to expel him from the regiment. And then the president wanted to take him back again, so we, half of us just said, let's stick it, we don't want it. He ripped us off once, he's not going to do it again. But I'm also a life member of the State Ambulance, life member of the RSL, with the Korean Southeast Asia Association. I'm also in Legacy, joined Legacy in 1980, been a legatee ever since. I was chairman of the Country Widows Legacy Camp, chairman of the Lower Murray Legacy Group. That was an area that took in from Kanmantoo to Pinneroo, from Swan Ridge to Meningie. I've had a fairly hectic lifestyle. Comes to never home. And when I was legatee at Woodside, I had 29 widows I was looking after. That's widows of ex-servicemen. They kept you busy. I'm now on the reserve list of legacy because I had a quadruple cardiac bypass surgery and that knocked me around a bit.
How long, when was that?
That was in 2007, and the surgeon did the operation saw me about a week or so later. He said, if I'd have known your lungs were in such a rotten state, I wouldn't have bothered operating. But thanks very much.
How do you feel today?
I'm still here. That's what, 12 years ago. I had a stroke. Left me sort of slightly weak in one side, on the left side. Piece of my bowel removed in 2016. I'm under a lung specialist at the moment. They drained 800 mils of fluid out of my chest, which made me breathe a little easier for a while, but it's back again. And they're not sure what to do with it now. So I'm working on one good lung. I take my dog for a walk every night for about 45 minutes, and I try to keep myself going. And up until this coronavirus, I used to go to the Korean Southeast Asia Association meeting every month, legacy meeting every month, and I'm still going. Piece of old flotsam and jetsam from the Korean War, but I'm still here. We used to have 5 Korean vets at Manum, but I got a feeling I might be the only one left now. One of them died 6 months ago. One died about 2 years ago. One of them was in hospital. And I don't know, I haven't heard from him for quite a while, so I presume he's gone. There's still one Korean vet at Murray Bridge, I know of. The president of the Korean Southeast Asia Association is a Korean vet. But he was in the Bath unit. Not too many of us left now. I know when I, quite a few years ago now, when I did a part of a survey on Korean veterans and their illnesses and everything, and they told me that, you know, there was only a few thousand of us left. And I thought, oh geez, you know, I can understand. Korea was a rather crude country in those days. 2 steps out to urinate, three steps out to have a shit. And outside every shack in the little villages, these heaps of human excrement, bucket it up, throw it into the paddy fields. So the hygiene wasn't real good. Temperatures got a bit low. The river the size of the Murray used to freeze over and they'd drive Centurion tanks across it. It was that bloody cold. I mean, one of our toilets were 44-gallon drums cut in halves with a hole cut in. One of our fellows made a mistake of sitting on it. When he tried to get off, he left a bit of skin behind and it froze. It was one quick lesson. Done there. Well, yeah, in the middle of winter, you'd have a leak, and before it hit the ground, it was frozen. And that's getting cold. Never eat yellow snow.
How did that affect the health of the soldiers?
The problem was we had every type of fleas, mites, lice. You know, we used to dust ourselves with DDT. We used to get in, you know, the old Johnson's powder tins. Came in tins like that, and all over. Just to keep the bun nice and level. It was a constant battle. Of course, they had all these funny bloody diseases like hemorrhagic fever and all that sort of thing. And you're sort of always worrying about your health. Of course, the food wasn't real good to start with. But we were on Yankee rations, we weren't too bad. A can of soup and a can of food, tin fruit, a Hershey bar and a packet of Camel cigarettes. because then they say, why did you smoke? Well, what else could you do with them?
Was it encouraged?
Well, I was encouraged so much as everybody smoked. Relax the nerves. You had nothing else to relax. I still remember in the front line, we did have one visitor regularly, old Major Winterson, the Salvation Army. And he was rattling down the trenches, in the front line, mind you. Coffee urn strapped on his back and a pannikin. Have a hot coffee, lad. Have you written home lately? Well, no, not really. Well, here, write a quick letter. Now address the envelope and I'll post it when I get back. Man, you got to be crazy. But he used to do that regularly. Up in the front line, heard a coffee on his back in the pannikin.
What a great man.
He was. He was one of the, a real gentleman. Thoroughly.
The significance and importance of those actions.
Well, most of it was just, hi mum, I'm well, your son, no, that was it. Unfortunately, when I left Korea, I left everything behind, including my camera and all my photos, all my personal gear, everything. And I never saw it again. I don't know what happened to it.
Did you document things a lot with photography?
Oh, I had hundreds of photographs. Because you get your films processed at the NAFI, the British Naval Army Air Force Institute. They used to have their vans. And when you come out of the line on rest, you put your film in and you get it processed. So I had quite a few photographs in the front line, looking across the valley at the enemy lines, and because it wasn't that far away. A few hundred yards, some places, a bit further. I remember one fella, there was a track along the hill opposite us on the hook, and this Chinese fella used to come out every morning and go for a run along this track and back around the hill again. One day, somebody in the machine gun decided to hurry him along, so he's but behind him, he got faster and faster, and just he went around the hill, they give him a full burst. He was entertaining, watching him every morning go for his run. That's the sort of war it was. Crazy.
Was that the end of that for that gentleman? Did he stop?
We didn't see him again, though. I think they might have got him. Why they did it, I don't know. I mean, he wasn't hurting us. I think he was just there to see whether he could draw any fire.
That's quite an incredible story, Jim, what you've just shared with me in the last hour or so. Like, you have done so much, contributed so much, been involved with so many different organisations and people. It's just amazing.
Just giving back something. I've been looked after. I've been well liked. I've had lots of friends. Met many people. Been to the government house, got my investiture in the Order of St John's. Met the governor again at the 100th RSL birthday party at Manham. He gave me the life membership shield from the Manham RSL. I met him a few times. He's quite a nice chap. As I said to him one day, I said, don't believe it, we are not really racist. I said, my wife's Japanese. I said, and we haven't got a Vietnamese governor, and he laughed. Well, we aren't really racist. I mean, I'm not. My best friends have been in the Aborigines. When I was at Tarcoola, the only kids I had to play with were Aboriginal kids that came off the desert. And I got a lot of respect for them. And the amount of shit that they've had to put up with in times. We had a family just down the road here. I always stop and chat with them. A lot of people don't like it because the house doesn't fit in with the rest of it. You know, they don't look after the garden too much. But they have a different way of life. We had one lad with us in the, when I was doing my basic training. He was an Aborigine. He'd go down to Melbourne every weekend. He'd come back and give away all his uniform. Oh, good day, bro. Gee, they're nice, but you? Oh, you want them? You can have them. Oh, nice trousers. Oh, you want them? Nice jacket. And he'd come back and he'd everything a complete new set of clothes. You know. But that was, that was his way. If he had something and you wanted it, oh, here, have it. I mean, generosity to a fault, really. But that's their way of life. And I don't think they'll ever really assimilate to us. We're too mercenary-minded. The holy dollar reigns supreme.
What do you think of... It is currently June 2020, and there's a lot going on in the world at the moment. Do you have any opinions or thoughts?
Don't start me on America. I've got no time for the Yanks, unfortunately. Seen the way they're going from Busan up to Seoul on the train. All the kids trying to sell us oranges on the side of the railway. And the bloody Yankee MPs were shooting at them. They were lucky the train pulled out because we were going to go and have them.
Did you witness a lot of disrespectful?
We're on the hook and the Chinese putting an attack on us. It was only a probing attack, you know, nothing really serious. The Yanks were on our left. Three battalions on our right and the Yanks were on our left. They pulled back 5 miles. Didn't even let us know. We're looking down over the Yankee position. That's strange, there's no cook on fires, there's no one moving around. Sent a patrol down there, there wasn't a soul there. They left our back door wide open. 3 o'clock in the afternoon they came back. The least you could have done was tell us you're leaving. They weren't even attacking them. They stick to the roads. They won't go off the roads. I know we're in reserve. It was Thanksgiving. So I was on the truck and went down to pick up supplies from the Yankee supply camp. They had all these frozen turkeys. I thought, can we have some of them? No, they're for Americans only. Well, there was a Kiwi truck alongside us. And the Kiwi said, hey, he said, what's this here? Grabbed a turkey and started running for the gate. Well, all the Yanks took us up. One of the two trucks and we drove off, picked the fella up on the way out. Waved goodbye, they went their way, we went ours. Got back to camp, the CO said, somebody stole turkeys from the supply camp. I said, yeah, it was them bloody Kiwis. Right, well, just make sure some get to the officer's mess. Right, sir. I used to go down and collect the bottle of rum. Used to get a bottle of rum issued in the wet, cold weather. And a navy rum, like bloody treacle. By the time I got back, the bottle was a third empty and topped up with water. Give it to the platoon sergeant. He'd take his share out and top it up with water and give it to the buddy. Platoon commander, he'd take some out and pop it up with water. By the time the troops got it, it was more like runny honey. They used to get about, just a drop in the bottom of the pannikin, you know. Mm. And then you fill it up with water and it was still bloody solid. Oh, beautiful stuff. Pure navy rum.
Was it... was alcohol a big part of the R&R?
Yeah, used to. We were issued with a bottle of beer, one bottle. Take that down to the Yanks and swap that for a bottle of whiskey. Take that back to the officer's mess and swap that for about 3 bottles of beer. It's good bartering, but that one bottle of beer didn't go very far.
No.
But you could always get the Yankee Budweiser. I was like drinking gin's piss. Shocking beer. Didn't appreciate that at all.
I'm just trying to process a lot of what you said to me, and it's there's a lot of information there, Jim. Do you find like a lot of these stories and experiences you've reflected on, they're pretty vivid for you still today?
Oh yeah. I still. Occasionally I have flashbacks of some of the nasty things, but that's pushed way back. You gotta be realistic, you know. No, I used to saw a shrink once. That was enough for me. And he said, stop bloody holding things in. Get it out. You've got to get it out. Talk about it. But who do you talk to? Unless you've been in the services and overseas, you don't really realise what it's really like. I mean, to look out over a bloody field of dead bodies piled up and think, I was responsible for that, you know. You never forget it. And it burns into your brain. And you look at it and you go, I did that. I was part of it. But it was them or us, preferably them. At the night of the big final battle we had, we lost 7 killed and 49 wounded. When take that out of 800 men, that's quite a lot. You never forget it, no matter how much you try to. As I said, I tried drink, but that doesn't help. When I got on the ambulances, I decided, well, I just had to give up. You can't go breathing all over patients with a beery breath on them. So I gave up drink, I gave up smoking. I feel a lot better for it. I don't take any puffers. Doctors keep me, you've got to have the puffers. And no, I don't. I've seen too many of my mates die because they have overdosed themselves on puffers. Half of them were on oxygen, carrying an oxygen bottle everywhere. I don't take oxygen. I don't take puffers. I refuse to. A mate of mine, he was a doctor on the flying doctors, and he said, stay off them as long as you can. Because once you take them, you become addicted and you can't do without them. And he's right. My dog keeps me alive, takes me for a walk every night whether I want to or not. And there are times when I would rather not go for a walk. I'd rather just sit there, but no, gotta go. So we go. He's my lifesaver.
How many years have you had this dog?
Only 6 years. The one before that we had 13 years. And the one before that, 16 years.
Wow.
But they keep you going. You've got to look after them. The problem is, of course, you get a dog, you know damn well you're going to outlive it. That's the way things are. You have no option. But while you've got them, you treat them right and they'll treat you. I mean, look at the way he took to you. He's the same with everybody.
A good nature, yeah.
Yeah. Look at the dog and look at the master and you'll find that the dog is the same as the master. You get a savage dog, don't trust the master. And the same thing when your dog meets him. If he believes they're good, he'll be good. But if he starts to move away from anyone, be careful with that person. I've looked at that always, and that's the way it is. Your dog, he's got more brains than we have. He's got a greater sense. I've had a good life.
Can I ask you, Jim, what's on the horizon for you for the next year or so? Do you have any plans for the next period?
No, I got to keep living. Got to go look after the wife. She said both shoulders replaced, both hips replaced, both knees replaced, and a spinal fusion. So she's more or less, you know, dependent on me, and she's on level 4 care, which is the highest care possible. But I've nursed her through everything. I said, we had two beautiful sons. One bought us this house. He said, no, he said, oh, we're living at Kalute. Kalute, there's no shops, no pub, no nothing. You want to go to the shops, you either go to Manham or Murray Bridge. I know I'm not going to keep my licence for much longer because my eyes are getting worse. But he said, no, he said, come down here. He said, you're closer to medical help. And he said, you know, I'll buy a place. He said, you can live in it for the rest of your life. He said, rent free. And I thought about it. But nah. Well, I got to be realistic because it's a long way from Kalute to Adelaide, 91 k's, you know. They come up and visit us. They've got the sun in their eyes going up and the sun in their eyes coming back. Whereas if I visit them, got the sun behind me going down, some behind me going back. So I used to have to drive to Adelaide to visit them. But since we've been down here, our granddaughter visits us at least once a week. The eldest son visits us once a week. He has dinner with us every Tuesday night. And the younger son, he only lives across the other side of Port Road. So he's always, you know, here. He does all the work on the house. Anything wrong, straight into it, you know. But they're both good kids. And we get to see our great grandkids.
How many grandkids have you got? Or great grandkids, do you say?
Four grandkids, four grandkids, three great grandkids, three boys, great grandkids, 5, 10, and 13. The 10-year-old, he plays footy. He's a mad keen footballer. Plays for the Goodwood Saints,
mm-hmm.
and the juveniles. The 13-year-old, he's not interested in sport. He's more on the mobile phone all the time, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah.
But they're good kids. And our sons, they're both good kids. The one that bought this place, was he worked in tax from the time he left the uni. They went to the uni and they took the top 10 in the class. Took him straight in as grade 3 clerks, which he went in and he stayed there. The other lad, he was a mechanic. He finished up, he was working for the mechanic at Woodside, and he got Mechanic of the Year award. He now works for the RAA, he's in charge of their IT section. But the youngest one, his two daughters, one has got her master's in engineering, she's working for aerospace, and the other one, they're twins, the other one doing biomedicine. They've all been pretty good. They're pretty brainy, all of them. I'm happy with life. I've had a good life. A bit rough at times. We finished up, got out of the army. I got a job at the Farmers Union. The wife got a job out at Scotsburn as the housekeeper. The old chap there, he's one of these rich fellas. He had 1,800 acres at Harrogate, another 1,600 acres down at, where was it?
That's up from Callington, isn't it? Sort of along that range?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
Rockley, I think it is.
Yeah, another 1,600 acres down Callington way somewhere. He had half shares in Knockatunga Station in Queensland. He owned three villages in England. Wasn't exactly short of money, you know. And she was his housekeeper. We had the servants' wing, 8 rooms. Beautiful old place. Then we built our own home in Woodside, and so that's where we stayed until I retired. I've had a good life.
You're turning 89 in October. What do you think are the important things for a good long life?
A good wife. And kids. I said, without my wife, I don't think I'd have lived as long as I have. I would have drunk myself to death long ago. But she's put up with me. And I said, she's always been there. And I said, I've looked at some of my old army mates and other things. They died when they were 60s. And I'm still here. I must have done something right. You know, you've got to have a philosophical outlook on life. You can't not control everything. What you can control, you do your best. And I find that helping others is much better than helping yourself. By helping others, you know, you make other people happy and you become happy. But, I know I had a hard life when I was a kid, one of 8 kids in the Depression. But I think perhaps it didn't hurt me. I used to carry my shoes around my neck to high school. Put them on at the gate rather than wear them out, because I knew darn well that my parents couldn't afford them. And I finished that by left school, because to do your leaving examination, it cost £10 to sit for the examination in those days. My mum didn't have £10, so I didn't do the leaving. But I still, you know, I've managed, got a reasonably good life. My first bike was made out of bits and pieces picked up out of the rubbish dump. It was a rickety old thing with 2 different size wheels, and It was like riding a bloody mad horse, but, you know, it got me by. My first car was a 26 Morris Cowley, and that cost me £50. It didn't have a battery in when I got it, and it didn't have a battery in when I got rid of it. Set the spark right, a couple of pumps on the carby, one turn of the handle, and she'd start. And it got me where I wanted to go. It was my Rolls Canardly. Rolls down one side and the Canardly get up the other. But it used to take me from Woodside to Kapunda to visit my mum. I found that early in life, you don't buy too much on time payment and don't have credit cards. Wait till you can afford it. When I first got married, I had £100 in the bank. Now I've got a little bit more than that. When we first moved into Bracky, we had no furniture. Well, the first thing I bought was a bed and a kitchen table, an old Laminex kitchen table and four chairs. That's all we had to start with. We used to sit on the floor in the lounge room on cushions around the fire. You know. Then gradually, as I could afford stuff, I bought it until we finally had all we needed. Now it's a lot easier, but I still have old furniture, but it's still good. My bed, it's a hospital type bed, and DVA got that from me because I'm on an EDA, extreme disability allowance. So they look after me. Anything I want, no problems. Pretty soon I'm going to be asking them for a gopher.
That's the little motorised.
Yeah, motorised thing. Because once I lose my licence, that's it. I like to go shopping by myself, but the moment the wife has, through her carers, she gets taken to shopping once a week and brought home again. But I like to drive myself. Don't like to rely on other people too much. If I can do it myself, I'll do it myself. If I can't, well, then you have to rely on someone else. But I've always had to fend for myself. And being the eldest boy, sort of get lumbered with paying for my father's funeral and paying for my mother's funeral. Middle brother, he was a ordained Baptist minister. He arranges all these things, but he never pays. He's good at organising. Oh, we want to put a plaque on Dad's grave, you know. Yeah, well, how about everyone tossing in? Yeah, well, everyone's agreed to it, you know. When it comes to getting the bill comes to me. Yeah, righto, whatever. You can't take it with you. You might as well spend it now.
True.
Mm. I mean, it's no good being rich in heaven because you can't spend it. I'm not what you'd call churchified. I haven't been to church for quite a few years. But I still believe in the old adage, do unto others as you'd rather them do unto you. Whoever thought that one up was a wise man or woman. Yeah. Well, when I was five, Beltenna, we lived next door to a fellow out of Donkey Team. He used to have this big wagon with a water barrel on it. He used to take the Donkey Team down to Sliding Rock, fill it up with water, and then come back again. And being the adventurous type, I hitched right on the back of his wagon one day. It used to take him a day to drive to Sliding Rock, a day to fill the barrel, and a day to drive back. He gets down to Sliding Rock. What are you doing here? I come for a ride. Oh, my God. Of course, by this time, I'm missing. No one knew where I was. I grabbed an Admiral Stocksman off the station to ride back and let him know that I was safe. I'm not as full of tricks like that, you know. Adventurous. And my sister decided to spear me with a garden fork. She knew a little hole there. That was all right. And then she scratched the scab off and I got tetanus. Well, the nearest doctor's at Port Augusta. He said, it's not worth me coming up. There's nothing I can do. So a month later, he'd come up to do his normal monthly visit. I'll sign that death certificate for you. Which death certificate? That kid with the tetanus. Oh, that's him out there playing. There's two bush nurses. They nursed me. No one was allowed to make any noise because when you get tetanus, the slightest noise, you go into wriggle. And that's what virtually kills people. You know. The trains weren't allowed to blow the whistle within 5 miles of the town. They weren't allowed to, they had to start slowing 5 miles out so that when they pulled up, there was none of this bang, 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 bang with the carriages.
Mm-hmm.
They got me through it.
What age were you when this happened?
Five, or just under five then. So I've cheated to death a few times. was in the one of these accidents at Packer. They gave me 3 months to live. I about lived all of them. 9 months later, I was in Korea.
There you are.
Right. Then I got blown up by a bloody mortar. Still alive.
You're indestructible, Jim. Can I just say thank you so much for sharing your stories with me today. It's been an absolute privilege to meet you, and I wish you all the best for the future. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Wow.
It's been a pleasure.
You have been listening to The RSL, A Time to Celebrate, 2020.